Hello, and welcome to The Leap of Faith. Well, on this evening's show, I'll be speaking with two men whose names will be very familiar to you, at least to all those rugby fans among you. It is, of course, the eve of the Six Nations Rugby, when Ireland will take on Italy at the Aviva Stadium. And as the pressure builds, focus is on the players who will pull on those green and azuri jerseys. Earlier this week, following on from Ireland's victory against France, Stockdale and McKinley sat down here in the studio right across from me, and it felt like a bit of a coup. As we know, Jacob Stockdale proved his worth in the Irish team last Saturday.
Now Stockdale gathers that one and carries it now and gets around a sort of would-be challenger there, brings play towards the 22-metre line. Ireland injecting a little bit of pace there now as Conor Murray has it now. Cian Healy there under pressure there from Kevin Gourdain. And it's moved back inside here now towards Jacob Stockdale, finding a road frontage here.
Jacob will also be on the team tomorrow. And in an unusual twist, Dublin-born Ian McKinley is one of the 26 in the Italian team who've travelled over for the match.
Ball comes quickly and there are numbers out wide for McKinley in the day one. The day one will surely straighten and then offloads and away they go once more. Back inside, McKinley finds his way around.
Ian lost the sight of his left eye following an accident on the pitch in 2010 and now plays with specially adapted goggles for Benetton Treviso in Italy. But one thing I'd better clarify is that the McKinley and Stockdale sitting across from me were the seniors rather than the juniors, the dads of these two rugby titans. Horace McKinley and Graeme Stockdale have one other significant thing in common. They both happen to be clergymen. Canon McKinley from County Tipperary was ordained a Church of Ireland priest almost 50 years ago. His father was also a long-serving clergyman, and he's been the rector of White Church Parish in Dublin for 41 years. Reverend Graeme Stockdale from County Antrim balances two contrasting chaplaincy jobs, one at a hospice in Uri and the other two prisons in Northern Ireland. And so to the interview. Gentlemen, you're both very welcome to the programme. And before we kick off, just to say that there is a court case going on in Belfast Crown Court at the moment, which we can't refer to in the course of this interview. So, can I ask you both, have you actually met each other before? Have your paths crossed? Horace, Graeme?
No, I haven't met Horace before. I've obviously watched his son Ian and intrigued to maybe find out a wee bit more in the programme about the background to the goggles and all that type of thing. It's good to meet up with him today.
And the fact that you both have quite a number of things in common. Similarly for you, Horace.
Absolutely. I've never met Graeme before and it's a privilege to meet him. And obviously I've greatly admired his son, Jacob, and particularly coming off hot, if you like, after that memorable victory out in Paris as well.
Well, I think we'll be returning to the topic of rugby before this interview is over. But let's go and find out a little bit more. Horace, can I begin with you? Was there any notion at an early age, or when did you have the idea that you might end up in Holy Orders?
As a little boy, we had about quite a lot of land attached to our rectory, which was common then in rural Church of Ireland. And rectors could lease it or farm it. And I think it probably contributed to our family being educated. But it was coming home as a little boy in the dark from milking the cows. The night sky had an enormous effect. From the age of four, five, 6 years of age, I felt there was something bigger in this life. So the God part of it, if you like, for me came in. It wasn't Jesus first. It was actually a sense of awe from the wonderful night skies you get in the countryside and which you don't get in the city due to all the artificial lighting. And I used to wonder in my little mind, was it accident or was it design? Didn't use those words, obviously. I used to talk to my dad about it. And that's really was the spark for me.
Did you ever get an answer to that question?
I'm not sure if I got a direct answer, but it was probably gently steered in a certain direction. But I must say, I made my own mind up. And at a young age, I myself went for design, which is in a sense, an act of faith on my part. It was the beginning of faith, if you like.
We'll talk more about the rest of that journey in a moment. But Graeme Stockdale, you're also with us. What was your start then to a life of faith?
Oh, well, it was a very specific decision to follow Jesus whenever I was about 9. I was brought up in a Christian family. Mum and Dad were both very involved in the local Presbyterian church in Antrim town, where I grew up. Dad was an elder in the church, and they started the youth club in the church. So my whole life pretty much revolved around the church. And they encouraged me to go to all the organisations in it. And it was just at one of those clubs, those groups, an organisation called the Christian Endeavour, that, I would say that God spoke to me.
You said God spoke to you. What does that sound like?
Yes, in my experience, it wasn't an audible voice, but a conviction, I would say, in my heart, that a certain path was the right path to follow. In terms of, you know, what does that sound like? It's more about what does that feel like? And I just felt, there's no alternative at that point in my life than to, I suppose, be a disciple of Jesus, you know, to follow Jesus at that point. I remember standing in my local primary school the next day after I'd made a decision and really overwhelmed with a sense of belonging to God's family. You know, I had a wonderful human family who loved me very much, but just really deeply impressed by this notion that I was now part of a family that was worldwide.
Lars, you're what, 41 years, is it, in my church?
Yes. Curiously, I was young when I went there, and now, of course,
we're well so young. Exactly. But I'm just thinking about the idea of when you put that much time into one parish and one community, you get to know everybody, they get to know you. What does the work entail? Is there such a thing as a typical day even for you?
I don't think so. I wouldn't have missed that opportunity for anything. It's been hugely rewarding, hugely enriching, working with some remarkable people, and I've enjoyed it immensely.
Because I think you both would carry the idea about presence, about being there for people. If there's administrative stuff in the way, if there's the day-to-day running of things, that cuts into that presence?
Undoubtedly.
Yeah, Michael was actually the main reason about 10.5 years ago that I decided to take a step out of parish ministry. I just found increasingly I was spending less time with people in the parish, more time in meetings and more time developing a strategy for this, that and the other thing.
I'm curious too that if you often hear the discussion from your Roman Catholic clergy colleagues when it comes to the idea of married priests, you both have partners. Have you been able to be free to give them as much time as you would like to? Graham?
Again, I would say that this is perhaps part of the reason, again, that I took a step out of parish ministry. But I got to the point in my life when I heard the phone ringing at home. I was immediately thinking, you know, who's died, who's sick, who's not happy, you know. So there was a real invasion of the manse for me.
Horace?
I have been blessed in having a wife who has been a magnificent kind of organiser and catalyst for the whole family, because you're all the time, certainly when the children were younger, you're caught in this sort of dilemma as which do you give to at this point, that point. In this particular role, it is really 24 hours. You rarely get any chance to get time off. And really, my better half was in control and is in control and steers the ship.
Were there moments missed in the children's lives growing up for you? Because you both have children.
Yeah.
Who we'll be talking about in a moment.
Yeah, I have to look back. I served in two parishes, particularly in the first parish, when my three children, there's Jacob, of course, and Hannah and Lydia. And fortunately, I look back at the early years of their lives, and it's just a bit of a blur to me. When you go into your first parish, you sort of think you're Superman, that you're there to sort everything out. Thankfully, I've learned a bit from that.
Horace?
Yeah, I think much the same as what Graham has said, and possibly if I was starting again, I think I would review certain parts of that.
Well, that said, we have some children we want to talk about as well. And this gives you to the gentlemen who have another item in common. And obviously we've got Graham Stockdale with us, your son Jacob. Plays a bit of rugby, I believe.
He does a wee bit, yes.
Tell us that influence and where that came from.
Yeah, we've always been a rugby mad family. Yeah, I think that's probably a good way to describe it. My father was a very good rugby player. I played a bit, and Jacob, of course, plays a lot and plays to a very, very high standard. Can't remember what stage it was, but certainly when Jacob was very young, my dad arrived with a rugby ball. You know, it's one of the first presents that he gave to him. I think it was maybe placed in the cot beside him so that, you know, that he might look at this, and, you know, that would be one of his first memories, yeah.
When did he show potential?
Possibly a sort of a late developer. Jacob, when he was about maybe 13, 14, 15, well, it would have been sort of maybe below average height, which is a bit different to what he is now because he's 6'3". I think just in his, by the end of fifth year, going into lower sixth, so he was about 16 and a half, he decided to take his rugby thing a wee bit seriously. He trained that summer, and it just corresponded with a remarkable growth spurt. You know, suddenly he was shooting up. So that was when it developed.
Did he have conversations with you about it? Did he seek any guidance from you?
Yeah.
Because it's tough sometimes to go to somebody that close to you for advice.
Yeah, yeah. I don't ever remember him actually approaching me for advice. I think we were always approaching him. Because, you know, whenever I was at school and rugby was an amateur sport, there was no choice in it. You know, the academic side should come first. Your job, your vocational side, your career, that was what was going to earn you the money, and you enjoyed rugby along with that. But in the professional era, I suppose whenever there was a critical point at around about just coming towards the end of his schooling. So he was 18. He'd been offered a place in the Ulster Academy. He'd been involved in the Ireland under-18s. He was shown a lot of potential. And we went to a meeting one night just to talk about all of this. And it became a reality to myself and my wife, Janine. Well, yes, he could make a career from this. So just with that opportunity and the potential that he had, then the conversation changed a bit from, yeah, look, the schooling has to be first and the sport has to be second, to perhaps you need to focus on the sport for now and see how the other side of life falls into that.
Is there room for pride in that?
Yeah, I think you can be... I'm proud of his achievements because he's a very committed, dedicated young man. He has his own personal Christian faith. He also, you know, is just a lovely young man. I have to say that as his father. He's a joy to be around. So I was very proud of him in every way, you know, not just his sporting achievement.
Were you able to watch the... match on recently, the Ireland-France match?
Well, I could hardly bear to watch it because I suppose the try that France scored, you know, I thought Ireland were fairly well in control up until that point, and, you know, we're always ahead in the match, and there was maybe an accumulation of mistakes that led to the try, but I suppose I was hoping that Jacob might have made the tackle, but the guy just evaded him. And I honestly thought that was it. That was it. There's no coming back. And I just so happy to see that kick going over the bar.
It's an obvious question I have to ask you, but yeah. Was there prayer involved on your part?
Yes, there was prayer. Well, let me just sort of address that. I pray before a match. I pray for everybody who's going out to play there. I do pray that each player, not just on the Ireland side, will play to the best of their ability. I pray that there'll be no serious, no serious injuries, particularly head injuries, which was a feature of the Ireland-France match as well.
Horace McGinley, your son Ian, is another name that people will know, playing for Italy at the moment. Tell us the backstory for Ian and how he found himself doing what he does now.
Well, he, like Jacob Stockdale, he was a very talented player here. He went through the kind of systems here, Ireland under 19, Ireland under 20. He had academy. He was already started on the full Leinster team, got some games there, and had an unfortunate accident where he lost the sight in one eye. And that seemed as if his world had collapsed completely. And through the Leinster branch, he got a position out in Italy with a newly formed junior club. And he decided to go there at 21, I think. And Italy has really been very, very good to him, because in the course of being out there, he eventually discovered about these trial goggles. And eventually, after a whole long, elongated process, he got approval to play with them. They are protective of the fact that he has one working eye, got back into a bit of junior rugby, then got played a bit with Zebre, played against Ulster, I remember.
Yeah.
Up in Kingspan Stadium, and then he got signed by Treviso, Benetton Treviso. He lives in beautiful Treviso. It's called Little Venice. It's one of the most beautiful places I've ever been. It's full of little canals, water mills. It's a walled place. It's quite beautiful, Treviso. So he lives in a lovely place. He got married last summer, had the privilege of solemnising his marriage to a girl who he met here in school in Dublin, but she's actually from County Derry. And so I was able to take their marriage, which was great, in St. Titus Church, Ballaghy, County Derry. Yeah. So there we are. He, incidentally, Graham was filling in about Jacob and the ball being put into his cot by your father, I think. He had an interesting introduction, if you like. I noticed when he was a little boy on the beach, his balance, I thought, was very good for a little small boy. When we're on holidays, you know, in the west of Ireland, we used to go there for a week or so. I noticed his balance from a very young age with a football or anything. And then, curiously, we found on Saturday morning, as opposed to Sunday morning, Gaelic football. And he actually has an All-Ireland Féile medal with Kilmacud Crokes. So he's very proud that, I think, that he's a son of a Church of Ireland rector and he has an All-Ireland medal. but that actually, I would actually say, having sort of followed him through that, that it's an incredible basis, actually, for rugby itself.
At one stage, Graham, you mentioned there about praying that people would get through the game safely. For Ian, that wasn't the case in one game where he, as you say, received an injury which resulted in the loss of sight in one's eye. What carried him through the recovery from that?
I think his family, his then girlfriend, the girl he'd met in school and whom we subsequently, of course, married. She's been a wonderful ally and support to him all along. One of our other sons, Philip, and our daughter, Emma, they really were terrific researchers on this whole goggles thing, issue with the goggles.
So it wasn't a question of him not playing again. He had intended that he was going to, if he could.
No, I think really the door was closed until the trial goggles in, I think, a firm in Bologna, Raleigh, Philip discovered about them. And they started investigating it. This took some years to get approval. But he's an extremely resilient young man. He's a very committed kind of person. And he's quite a single-minded person as well. I couldn't myself answer the faith question, but I know he would listen as well to myself. I believe in various things, seeing I gave him quite a bit of advice in his early rugby playing days. I was his sort of unofficial coach. But I think deep down, he would realise through the support of other people, that there was a higher support as well.
Mm-hmm. And when you think about the work that you both do now, where you are with people who very often are facing, you know, traumas, bereavement, loss, imprisonment possibly even too, what works the best for either of you when you're in that situation, when you're faced with it, Graham?
I think a word that you referred to earlier, Michael, was presence. I've just come from the hospice today, and I spend most of my morning just with one family as they're seeking to support a young man who's at the end of his life. So a family that's heartbroken. They're in shock about what is happening to their son, their brother, and they're asking questions, not specifically of me, but they're just saying, "This is so unfair. How could this happen?" etc. And I don't have the specific answers. I hope that in time, perhaps they might be able to get a perspective on what they're going through now. But right at the minute, the emotions are so raw that it's simply just about being there. It's just about coming alongside. It's just about trying to identify the level that they're at and try to support them. Just in the lead up to Christmas, I was speaking at the hospice carol service. I was just focusing on one of the prophecies from Isaiah 61, where the prophet says that he has called me to bind up the brokenhearted. And I see that as a critical work. You just think about something that's broken. Can't stand on its own or can't support its own weight. But the ministry of binding that up, just being the support, in the hope that eventually, that brokenness will heal enough for that person to be able to stand and to be able to support themselves.
Because one of the obvious questions that both of you must be asked by relatives when they're faced with the loss of a loved one is, what kind of God would bring this suffering onto somebody? Horace, what do you do to answer that question?
I think what Graham has just said is something I'd identify with fully, that very often, and like Graham, I have come from an almost seemingly very unkind situation where someone has just died, younger person. And I totally agree with Graham. I think ministry is about presence. There's a famous writer whose name I can't remember said, "Your presence always precedes your words." Mm-hmm. How true that is, that people remember that you journeyed with them. And I find years on, people write to you at Christmas, 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago, soldiered along with during trauma, and here they are still writing to you at Christmas. What was the link? There was some link, Michael, that was established by your presence. Very often, I think we have to be honest and say, we don't know slick, pious answers to a lot of things like this. But maybe by our presence, somehow or other, we represent, if you like, the unfailing presence of God in Christ. And people do remember your presence. They don't necessarily remember the eloquence of your words at funerals, memorial ceremonies and so on.
In contrast to the hospice, Graham, you also work in the prison system.
Yeah, that's right.
And I just want to jump there for a moment, because I'm hoping that there may be room for some optimism for you in the people that you meet. People who are in there through various different decisions they made in life, and then they take an opportunity to talk with you and maybe change their perspective or...
Yeah, I mean, just Christmas past, we invited a former prisoner to spend Christmas Day with us. And my two daughters heard about this, and they sort of sidle up beside me, Dad. Heard that you've invited an ex-prisoner for Christmas Day. Do you mind us asking what he was in prison for? I said, well, actually, it was armed robbery, you know. And I said, you're bringing him here? I said, well, I think he's learned his lesson. And and actually, it's not an understatement to say we had a wonderful day. And the same two daughters came to me afterwards and said, that was a really good thing to do, Dad, because actually he enjoyed himself, but it contributed to our day to be able to have done that for him.
Yeah. Well, of course, now this weekend will be an opportunity for us to see people at their best too.
I'm fairly conservative in these matters, so I would never pass. I think you're only as good as your last game, and particularly in relation to Ian's journey, I think you just take, his last game as his great gift in his rebirth, if you like. As a player, so I don't look ahead myself. That's just a personal view.
If Jacob's selected to play on Saturday, we plan to be at the Aviva. My wife and I sort of do a double act, in that my wife can't bear to watch. You know, really, her ticket is a wasted ticket, you know, because she sits with her head in her hands, not able to watch, and praying most of the time. And I do my radio commentary. I tell her what's happening next. As
it's her little baby.
Yeah. And so I thoroughly enjoy rugby. I view with a degree of anxiety whenever Jacob is playing, which I think is very common to all parents. You want your son to perform in a way that he's going to be happy with. You know, at the end of the day, he's my son.
Well, whatever about the players, they've got two fantastic dads, and our special thanks to Canon Horace McKinley and the Reverend Graeme Stocktail. Thank you for both joining us on The Leap of Faith.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
From all of us on the programme this evening, good night.